1972, that the Attorney General issued an opinion which deals with, I think, almost every one of these problems. It has to do with education, the problem of representation, the problem of the city being both inside and outside the borough, and then the problem of future borough development in the area. Were you familiar with that opinion?
Very much. I'm very familiar with it.
I thought that you were talking about the items as being mentioned, that opinion as being a recent development.
There's still other items mentioned that wasn't in that opinion of a year ago. You recall, too, Mr. Chairman, I'm sure.
I'm not aware of which items are which here. I'm not that familiar with the subject matter here.
I'm going to ask Mr. Spencer, who's going to respond to the Attorney General's matter of legal basis.
Fine.
He was here yesterday and heard his presentation.
Any other questions? Senator Hensley?
Ms. Sharp, you indicated that whether or not you received state revenue sharing funds, the council is still interested in the annexation. Is that correct?
Yes.
I understand that one of your reasons for desiring to assume annex the bases is the fact that you feel that there may be some changes in the defense outlays up here, and that perhaps they may be closed, and you want to be in a position to provide some planning and whatnot, keep up the services in the areas. Is that correct?
Yes, I don't think you'll get utilization of those improvements in the facilities, unless someone does.
Well, isn't it, won't these bases, though, revert to the borough if, in fact, there is a closure of one or the other? Isn't that?
No. No, normally what would occur is that the military and the General Service Administration would decide whether they're surplus property or public domain, then dispose of it accordingly. If it's surplus, there's a priority, starting with federal agencies, the state, and all that.
Mr. Chairman, in terms of municipal jurisdiction, though, doesn't this 1963 law apply? We have a copy of it here where it indicates that so long as the following areas, and they list off about seven bases, so long as they remain military reservations, they would be excluded from any borough. But it says that, provided, however, that when an area shall no longer be subject to a military reservation, it shall become a part of the borough surrounding it. Isn't that the present law?
Yeah, I believe it is.
Well, even though they might become a part of the borough under those circumstances, the authority to provide service doesn't change. We're in the street business. We're in the water business, the electric, the telephone. The fact that the area would come within the boundaries of the borough wouldn't change the authority to provide services.
I mean, wouldn't then that be the responsibility of the borough, though, rather than...
Not to provide the services for which the city's responsible, no. We're on the basis, incidentally, we're going in with the Class B telephone service on Fort Richardson, a matter of... Well, the contract should be signed, a matter of weeks, months, perhaps. So we're in the bases. We have a joint intake facility for water. We're on the base facility right now.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as far as I'm concerned with respect to the annexation, you know, if it's a proper annexation and it's not going to impact the, you know, the rest of the communities in the state with respect to revenue sharing, you know, I've got no hang-ups about the annexation if they want to go provide services for the bases.
Well, we but have some more testimony
simple,
here, but
yeah.
Mr. Chairman?
Are you through, Senator Hensley?
Yes.
Senator Thomas?
If I could just ask one more brief one. I'm still puzzled about this whole matter of the revenue thing a little bit. If the city were to annex the bases and forego or not receive revenue sharing, I would assume that the bases would require that the city pick up at least some of the cost of services on those bases. And how would the city then proceed to pay for that? Where would they go to do that?
Mr. Chairman, the military is going to continue to provide the same thing they provide on the reservation after annexation as they do now. It isn't going to change their responsibility one bit. It's federal property, and they should continue to do so.
But if they become part of the city, aren't they going to say, okay, you can take over some of the load, too?
No, Mr.
Can you be sure?
Chairman, no, I don't think so. If they asked us to take over their fire stations, they're non-taxable. We would say, no, thank you. And the same as maintenance of their streets, the same thing. It's federal property. It's not taxable. This is no problem, Senator. It's occurred all over the country. It hasn't created a problem between the city and the bases as to who pays what. And the matter of jurisdiction, as far as criminal activity is concerned, that's well settled up here already, so there's no problem.
Senator Thomas, is that...
Yes,
Senator Hensley?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think, I think the state would be actually obligated to to pay them whatever they would be due depending on their population that they acquired, then we'd have to change the Revenue Sharing Act, I would think.
Any further questions for Mr. Sharp? Senator Groh?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, how much money do the bases presently pay the city for services, such as they don't provide you don't provide them with water or anything?
We have a joint intake facility with them, Mr. Groh.
Do they pay you anything at all? Do you get any income from them presently?
Well, we sell them electricity and telephone service, this type of thing. We provide policing on part of the area inside the city that's involved, in the streets and the sewers up there. That's the Wherry Housing Project that you're familiar with. But other than that, anything we provide is a matter of contract.
How much does that amount to in money, approximately, per annum? Do you know for how much they pay you?
For water and
for
electricity?
Everything?
I don't know. I'd have to check. We're selling about 5,000 kilowatts of power. A substantial amount of money is involved. It's contracts between us and standard tariff rate.
Just one other question. You know, Mr. Sharp, many of us have been involved in the so-called borough city conflict for many years. What's the basic reason, as you understand it, to ask you the $64,000 question, that the borough opposes this annexation?
I hope I find out. There's no valid reason that I know of for them to oppose it at all. I don't know why.
Thank you.
I hope I find out this afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions?
We're talking about the assembly. We're not talking about the borough government opposing it.
Any other? Mr. Carroll?
Yes, just a minute. You said the borough assembly, not
yes.
The borough government. You're separating the borough mayor
well,
office
I
from...
Well, I think that the borough administration has an area of responsibility, and they take positions on matters that not always in agreement with the assembly. And this is apparently one of those cases.
What about the city government as opposed to the city council?
I work for the nine people, and their policy is my policy. And I carry it out, and that's my responsibility.
Thank you.
If I don't like what they do, I can quit.
Mr. Sharp is the fastest gun north of Seattle.
Yes, I really think that right.
He's a good gunman. He's working for the state, too. You know? Mr. Sayers, you had a question?
No, Mr. Chairman. I was only going to make the analogy that if the city council represents the wishes and the will of the people in the city of Anchorage, I would assume that the representatives of the borough government are representing the will of the people outside the city, too.
The vote was 6-5. Now you figure out how it came about.
Any other questions of Mr. Sharp? Why don't we take a 5-minute recess? We're beginning to run over our time, which is, of course, no fault of yours, Mr. Sharp. But I want to urge upon the other city representatives to try to cut your time down here if you can. So take a 5-minute recess.
Clear up a point asked by Mr. Saylor a few minutes ago having to do with military police and their activities inside of the cities. A Hawaiian case several years ago, I forget what the name of it is, but anyway, that case simply establishes the fact that when a military person leaves a military reservation, he is totally the responsibility of the civil authority. The second part of that authority is concerned with the posse comitatus that I'm sure that you're familiar with, which precludes military authority from assisting in the apprehension of or in the investigation of civil law. Keep in mind also that primarily military personnel off of bases are not in uniform, therefore they do not know, and they have no right or authority to inquire of that individual if he is in fact military from the danger that he might be severe. So that should pretty well clear up that point. We do not, in fact, have military town patrols. They have a sergeant who comes by as a liaison, and that's about the extent of it. We furnish much information for them on activities, but that's about the extent of them being involved in the enforcement downtown. I'll read through this very quickly, then if there's any questions, I'll be glad to answer. The military bases are situated very close to the city. In the case of Elmendorf, the city and base have a common boundary. Two of the main roads leading from the base directly into the central business district and the distances are very short. I'll point out that the distance from the Government Hill Gate to 4th and C Street, where the major impact is 1.6 miles. The distance from the Elmendorf Gate on Post Road is 2.3 miles. Many of the soldiers, especially in the summertime, walk into the Central Business District where they entertain themselves. The Central Business District of the City of Anchorage is attractive to many of the young men on both bases. A large percentage of the military personnel are attracted to the downtown area because of the abundance of shops, businesses, and bars in the Central Business District. Wherever there are concentrations of men, and especially young men, there is also the concentration of the vice elements, the criminal elements of the community, which wish to peddle their wares, so to speak, to these military personnel. Patrol commanders on this department estimate that on a weeknight, 30% of the persons in the Central Business District are military. On a regular weekend night, about 50% are military. And on a military payday, as high as 80% of those individuals in the downtown area are military personnel. The Central Business District is by far the highest crime rate area in the city. And certainly the high concentration of military personnel is a major contributing factor. And if I could, I have black and white copies of that same map that I'll leave with you also. This is simply a pin map that shows in six categories of crime what the concentration of those crimes are. These are primarily the assaults and batteries, the larcenies and so forth that are concentrated in the Central Business District. And the colored pins will give you an idea as to that large concentration. The afternoon and night patrol shifts of the police department are primarily affected. Let me explain to you also that the divisions you see within the city are patrol areas. Those lines dividing up the city are patrol areas, and they are constantly manned 24 hours a day. The standard patrol assignment breakdown allots two uniformed patrols to the Central Business District area and one foot patrol officer to the Central Business District. On payday nights, additional foot patrols are assigned. In addition to the patrolman, the shift supervisor concentrates in that area also. Although military personnel and their dependents are attracted to all parts of the city, the greatest concentration is by far the Central Business District. To ensure adequate police personnel, on payday nights and weekend nights, we augment the downtown force, and all over the city for that matter, but primarily in that area, with auxiliary forces. We have, at the current time, some 32 to 34 auxiliary men who are out working in the cars as a regular officer to augment our capabilities in these areas. They walk foot patrol, everything that the patrolman does. When we compare this concentrated effort with our other military-related contacts throughout the city, we estimate that a minimum of 15% of our uniform patrol function is military-related. Military men also comprise the highest percentage of those persons who are contacts of prostitutes, and subsequently, these men, therefore, are most frequent victims of assaults and rollings committed by the working girls of the city of Anchorage. In 1972, study conducted by the vice section of this department determined that 30% of this type of crime and incidents involve military personnel or their dependents. Let me go one step further with this particular point. In a very detailed investigation of one bar, which came to our attention last year and which subsequently action was taken against, this investigation conducted of activities over a long period of time showed without doubt that 41% of the individuals in contact with prostitutes, pimps, and so forth, 41% of those were military personnel. In the area of drugs, there is no way to determine what the exact percent of military use of some type of drugs is. Information supplied by our investigators, our intelligence unit, and federal agents indicate that a minimum of 10%, and probably closer to 20%, of all drug cases worked in the Anchorage area, or the Anchorage Police Department, involve military or their dependents. Most military personnel and their dependents involved in drugs are considered an enforcement problem for the Anchorage Police Department, primarily because the on-base situation is a more governed and a more disciplined society. Those individuals who are living on the bases, who are involved in this kind of activity, come into the city to conduct their activity. Most of the buying, selling, and so forth of this kind of material is done off-base and in the city. Let me point this study out to you also. To give you an example, in one particular case, an undercover officer working at an establishment in the city where a lot of young people were congregated, he made 15 cases, or 15 buys, from youngsters. Seven of those individuals were military dependents. To give you an idea of what this impact is, 10% here in this area is a very, very minimal. But we don't know. There is no way to know or ever establish what the true percentage is. In the area of police contacts with citizens, research which was conducted during the month of July, August, and September of 1971 and repeated again for those same months in 1972 shows that the Anchorage Police Department makes personal contacts with 126 persons per day, not considering traffic, of which a minimum of 19, or 15.1%, are known to be military related. Personal contacts are only part of the police function, so this does not necessarily mean that only 15% of the average workload is military connected. This, when considering the records section, constitutes an absolute minimum of 15% of the function of that bureau. It is also estimated that 15% of the communications costs and training and community relations effort are military related. In the area of police investigations, the 15% also holds true. Another area of police concentration and cost is that dealing with moving and non-moving traffic violations. A review of our 1972 records show that 10% of the total number are military or their dependents. Here again, gentlemen, this is a very basic minimum, and here's why. Again, I'll repeat that the military control is a better control than society at large. It's a more disciplined society. An individual receiving a citation in the city of Anchorage or being contacted by a police officer, about the last thing that individual wants to happen is for his commander to find out about it. If he has an off-base address that he can list, he's not going to let you know he's military if he can help it. He simply don't want it known on the base that he is military. Therefore, again, we've got to go on a minimum, and I think a 10% is a very, very low minimum. Figuring a minimum of 10% of the total citations, we determined during 1972 that 18,435 non-moving violations and 1,177 moving violations were issued to military and their dependents. Although it is recognized that many civilian personnel work on both Elmendorf Air Force Base and Fort Richardson, the overall traffic problem in relationship to those bases is worthy of note. The map that you have on your left up here, the one closer to me, the red tape running through the city of Anchorage indicates the major traffic routes through the city to the south, back and forth to the bases. According to the City of Anchorage Traffic Engineering Department, John, would you figure the Pofunkies out for me? An average of 8,825 vehicles a day pass in and out of the Post Road gate onto Elmendorf. Additionally, 10,800 vehicles use the two Government Hill access roads to Elmendorf. Since Fort Richardson is outside of the city limits, the traffic flow figures are not included, even though large percentages of the traffic volume flow off of Boniface Road and from the highway coming in from Fort Richardson Gate number 1. To give you a little bit better impression of how many vehicles are out there, how much traffic this generates, let me point out to you that between Elmendorf and Fort Richardson, there are 27,600 civilian-owned vehicles. 18,000 of these are on Elmendorf and 9,600 are on Fort Richardson, plus an unknown or classified number of military vehicles, many of which are flowing into and out of this traffic pattern daily. I want to point out to you also that there is no way to flow north and south here, except one route that does not go through directly through the heart of the city or through major portions on the east. The only route around the city is Muldoon, and it borders on the city in two places. Our warrant service section is that function dealing with service of traffic warrants, subpoenas, and minor traffic offenses, people who don't show up for traffic court and this kind of thing. Again, 10% of those documents are directed toward military people and their dependents. Additionally, the administrative cost which can be contributed to the military is estimated at 10%. The absolute minimum combined police department costs only as related to this document amount to $383,575 of the city of Anchorage. This figure is based on 15% of the annual operating budget of the Anchorage Police Department, which, as Mr. Sharp said, is $2,555,170. Now, I don't know as I should go further. I'll give you the complete statement that I've made and mention to you that attached to that statement are two documents. One of them are our 1972 crime statistic breakdown, and the second is 3 pages out of the AMATS map that they are projections, but they're simply there to show you that there's no indication that this north-south traffic flow will continue. In fact, it will increase very substantially if the projections of population are correct. If there are any questions, I'll be glad to try to answer them and turn this over to somebody else.
Any questions of the chief? Do I have any questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'll leave these maps here for anybody who might want them.
Are those the ones that you passed out before here?
Yes, sir. They're black and white copies of them.
I'll be glad to. Okay, why don't we, excuse me, Senator Hensley?
No, I have no questions.
Oh, all right.
Comment, sir.
Why don't you leave them there, and members can pick up and help themselves to a copy after a bit. Okay. Senator Hensley?
Right. The testimony sounds more like a plea for special police assistance more than annexation to me.
Well, shall we hear the rest of it? Okay. City Attorney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman Carroll, members of the legislature, ladies and gentlemen. I would like to limit my remarks briefly to matters of legal import which are raised by the Attorney General's opinion dated March 21st and some of the testimony which was reflected yesterday. There are three basic issues in that opinion that I think were brought out, although two of them are so interrelated I will cover them together. The third deals with the borough representation, which I think is rather moot because of the amendment to Section 4 of Title 10 of the Constitution. And as Mr. Sharp has pointed out a while ago, as far as borough representation is concerned, the annexation has absolutely no effect. If it's not in the borough, there's absolutely no borough representation, obviously, from those people. The Attorney General asserts in his opinion that a city in Alaska can be in one borough, whether that be organized or unorganized. I must respectfully disagree with that basic concept. The city of Anchorage has existed, as been pointed out here, in an unorganized and organized borough since the inceptions of the boroughs. The city boundary in that particular area were delineated in 1920. The founders of the Mandatory Borough Act, as the chairman full well knows, prior to the passage of the statutes in 1963, discussed, at least as I've come through my investigations, discussed the problems of the city and the borough boundaries with relationship to the military bases. I find no language in that act or any other act in the statutes limiting cities from being both in organized or unorganized boroughs, nor is there any limiting language concerning cities having included in their boundaries portions of military bases, even those bases which are spelled out as being delineated in the Mandatory Borough Act. One must read into this absence of legislative enactment some credence that cities were not to be excluded from prohibited military reservations, as stated in the Mandatory Borough Act. Those reservations stated in the Mandatory Borough Act. From the research I've accomplished in this area, I find that the Mandatory Borough Act excluded those military reservations solely because of the fear of loss of school impact funds, PLH 74 funds, which were made available through the federal government. These funds were and are the mainstay of the state-operated schools in Alaska. There certainly was logic in that if, in fact, the fears of loss of federal funds were justified in excluding those military bases. I think, though we have a situation concerning that yellow portion up there that has existed since the inception of the Bureau, which has allowed the state-operated schools to retain, obtain and retain monies for state-operated schools for the portion of Elmendorf Air Force Base, which is in Alaska. If I may point to the map, you see that there are three schools in this yellow portion, which have been operated by the state-operated schools since they were built. I have prepared a memorandum concerning the treatment of military dependents, and I passed that on to the department sometime in early 1972. I don't have copies of it. I thought I did, but I don't with me. But I think Commissioner Thomas yesterday testified pretty much to the applicability of PL-874 funds, at least to that area, and to the inclusion of the entire area into the city limits. It makes absolutely no difference as far as PL-874 funds are concerned. There is no impact. Just to digress from my notes here a minute, when this first came up, I personally investigated this matter from Mr. Cherry's level. He is the head of the PL-874 program in the entire United States and the commissioner of the Office of Education in Washington, D.C. We started at that level and came down and worked back up. Became very, very familiar with PL-874. Ironically, when we were about to finish our investigation, I found that Mr. Hedlund had been going the same route. I came to the same conclusions he did, and I think that Mr. Thomas did, as he testified yesterday. The annexation of the military bases into the city makes no difference to PL-874. Essentially, though, that problem, I think, should be laid to rest, because I really don't think there's a problem. If there was a problem, we would have seen it crop up before because of the dependent students of the 6,000-some-odd people living in that particular portion of the military reservation within the city limits. The state has been accepting those military, or those PL-874 impact funds for those three schools and the people that live in that area since the inception. So I think it would be tremendous precedent to overcome, which I haven't seen. So I'd like to move on to other portions of that opinion. The Honorable Attorney General cites certain portions of the Constitution in his opinion, which he feels would give, and to quote him, the constant use of the singular in describing city-borough relationships at least suggests that a city was to be located in a single borough. He's taken this out of Title 10 of the Constitution, and it does say borough, and it says assembly. It does not use a plural. However, I think the normal rule of statutory construction, it must be applied to the Constitution here as it is applied everywhere else. The normal rule is found in our Alaska statute at 01-10050, subsection B, which states in general, words used in the singular number include the plural, and words used in the plural number include the singular. When we take that basic concept, I think that there is no credence to be given, as suggested by the Attorney General in his opinion. There are other portions of that opinion which I have a conflict with. One was, certainly if boroughs were created afresh, with present standards, borough boundaries would not divide a city, as you see here. Now, the present standards that the Attorney General was talking about are standards which are found in 07-10.0C30 of the statute. It's ironic that those standards were passed by Chapter 146 SLA 1961, some 2.5 or 3 years prior to the Mandatory Borough Act. So those standards did apply when the Mandatory Borough Act was created. So the same standards applied then as applied now, so I don't see that there would be any change in the borough boundaries simply because of the standards. The standards are the same as they were when 52 SLA 1963 was passed, which is a Mandatory Borough Act. Certainly the legislature, knowing full well that the boundaries of the city of Anchorage were in this particular location, would have done something about the existence of the city in the unorganized borough when the Mandatory Borough Act was passed, but it did not, at least as far as I read the statute in the legislative history. As I mentioned earlier, there is no necessity to comment on the borough assembly apportionment problem because none exists. The simple fact of the matter is that this area is in the Greater Anchorage Area Borough, excluding this part here because it's not. That's the representation area for the borough. The people in this area are entitled to representation. If this area is not in the borough, they're not entitled to representation. If this area is not in the borough, they're not entitled to representation. The recent amendment to the Constitution under Section 4, Title 10, spells out the specific guidelines and then is found as a municipal code. The one-man, one-vote doctrine shall apply. It's very simple. If they're not in the borough, they're not entitled to representation. So there's no magic about that particular problem. And so there is no problem. The last thing I want to mention is the argument of U.S. Smelting case, which the Attorney General mentioned yesterday, found at page 140, Pacific Second 57. That case is so distinguishable from this case, it would be rather hard to cite a case like that as being what is known legally as being on all fours. There were regulations passed prior to the decisional meeting. All of the action taken in the hearings which were conducted on this this annexation were met. All of the requirements in that regulations were met. Notwithstanding the fact that that the regulations didn't exist at the hearing, they did exist at the decisional meeting, and they did exist when this matter was presented to the legislature. I don't intend to present legal arguments at this point because I don't think that this is really the place for it. To reject the application based solely on an attorney general's opinion as to the applicability of a decision which is not on all four squares would render this particular body subject to being the judge and the jury of a case which is not in existence. There would be a great question who would have standing. The case possibly and probably would never exist. I'd like to turn briefly, and I know time is of essence here, to some comments of yesterday. The accusation that resolution of January 8, 1972, which is the approval of the Local Boundary Commission, is stale, is, in my opinion, ridiculous. The Local Boundary Commission is an ongoing, constitutionally mandated body. They acted on a resolution and then later, a few days later, suspended their action for 60 days. And if I may quote part of their meeting of the Local Boundary Commission on January 18, 1972, Mr. Hedlund said in that, quote, the chairman continued to explain that no great harm would be done, as far as he was concerned, if the annexation were put off for 1 year. So his intent, obviously, and the intent of the commission, was approved by Mr. Ackerman, Mr. Bernsdorf, Mr. Sonst, and Mr. Hedlund, was that this matter was merely put off for 1 year. And so it was not their intent. And certainly the Local Boundary Commission is a constitutionally mandated commission which deals directly with the legislature. That commission's interest should be a paramount to any other supposed opinion later as to what they had to say. And I think that's in your packet. That's Exhibit 4, if you care to read it. It was prepared by the Commissioner Malott. Surely the Local Affairs Agency, as it was called then, could not transmit the resolution which was passed by the Boundary Commission after the 10th day of the legislature last year. So their action of suspending it for 60 days meant simply that it could not be passed until onto the legislature until during the first 10 days of this legislative session. That was the intent of the Local Boundary Commission. So to call that resolution stale now, in my opinion, is not correct. The matter alluded to by Commissioner Malott yesterday when he stated that his request or a demand or whatever it was to the Boundary Commission that they vote the matter up or down, I think is has absolutely no legal or legislative import. The fact of the matter is the Boundary Commission, and I'll state it from personal testimony, had considered that request of Mr. Malott and had considered all of the relevant items which were brought out yesterday as late as November of 1972. And in meetings between the Boundary Commission, Mr. Sharp and myself, we discussed some of these particular problems and as to the city's thoughts on them. So it's not a question. There was new evidence that they had not considered because these people were quite aware. They were aware of the Attorney General's opinion of March 1972. They had read and discussed U.S. smelting. They knew the military stand, which was read into the record yesterday. They knew the outcome of Bill 790 and 791. And any other reapportionment decision. These facts were discussed by the Local Boundary Commission in my presence. I think this matter boils down simply to, as I think Mr. Malott stated yesterday, the LBC, or Local Boundary Commission, is unneat. Now, if there's a personality conflict or a conflict between the LBC and Mr. Malott's organization or the Attorney General's organization, I think possibly that's something that should be aired in-house, but not brought an innocent third party into personality or political conflict. I don't think that's really the purpose that the Constitution had when they set out the Local Boundary Commission. So, one of the points made yesterday by the Attorney General in his testimony is the fact that he felt that there may have been a disannexation, or that that portion of the military reservation may not be in the borough, or may be in the borough now, may not be in the city now. He wasn't quite sure. The fact of the matter is, the Attorney General knows well that particular area is within the city limits, and it's not within the borough limits, and he knows full well that there's no special school problem. Attorney General, in a memorandum dated March 29, 1972, states, without getting into the details of the legal rationale adopted in your memo, and this is to Mr. Malott, it follows from our previous opinions that the area said to be part of the city of Anchorage within the unorganized borough and on Emmendorf Air Force Base does not constitute a city school district. So he understood the problem then. And as far as the city becoming a school district in that area, I can confirm, at least in my opinion, that the Attorney General's memorandum to Mr. Malott on March 29, 1972 is the same way that I feel. That is not a school district. It is not a problem there. And because of this, I think we boil it down to simply this. Is there a procedural deficiency? I do not think there is a procedural deficiency. I think the legislature has the authority act on this particular resolution. We hope that they act favorably to the petitioners, the city of Anchorage. I think for us to take the conclusion that because there is a conflict of opinion, and here we have a conflict of opinion between the same gentleman, the same office, the Attorney General's office, in my opinion, that we should then blow smoke on it and say there will be protracted litigation in this matter, so don't pass it. I think if you follow that approach, each time that this legislature was faced with a bill, we could come in and say, if you pass that bill, Mr. Chairman, we may have litigation, because goodness knows how many bills that are passed by both houses of this legislature do get involved in litigation down the line. If we followed that basic concept, we would never pass legislation. And this, we would allow an opinion of an attorney to determine whether or not legislation should be passed. I think that I'd have to rely more on simply on the wisdom of the legislature. I think that's why it's a separate organization, a separate form of our government, a separate portion of our government. I don't think that it's reasonable, rational, or fair to have an attorney's opinion state simply that I realize that other people are going to have conflict with me and possibly disagree with me, therefore there's smoke in the area, therefore you should not pass it. To me, that type of logic does not necessarily make good government. And for that, gentlemen, I would like to cut my presentation short because I know the time problem and everyone wants to get on that airplane. I do have copies, basically, of my comments that I made to you, and I will answer any questions that you may have.
I want to invite Representative Fisher to join us at the table if she would like to and participate as a committee member. You're certainly invited to.
And Representative Larry Peterson.
Oh, yes. Peterson, I'm sorry, I missed you. Didn't see you.
Representative Peterson is a member of the group here.
Yes. You're certainly welcome to seat yourself at the table if you wish. It makes it easier to ask questions if you do. Any questions of any of the legislators of city attorney? Let me ask you one. Tell me one more time what the yellow area represents on the map.
Mr. Chairman, the yellow area on the map seen on the right-hand side is the area which is in the city limits now, which is coincidentally in the on the military reservation.
Well, then what is the pink line supposed to represent? I thought that was supposed to be the military reservation.
The pink line is the area which is the subject of the annexation.
That's orange, isn't it?
Or whatever color it is. Okay. Does that encompass all of the rest of the military reservation?
No, sir, it does not. The military reservation comes down an area like this. This is military reservation, and this is Fort Richardson military reservation up to an area which is called Beach Lake, which falls up in this area here. This is all military reservation. It goes back up to the top of the mountain.
Does the borough assert jurisdiction in the area to the right, to the east of the city in there, in that area?
I don't know what they assert as far as jurisdiction, Mr. Chairman. Recently this summer, question is, what's base proper? I took a two-week course while I was on active duty at the Judge Advocate General School at the University of Virginia this summer, and I tried to get a definition, at least as far as the Judge Advocate of the Army was concerned, of base proper does not exist. I took the two-week course in military reservations. So I don't know what base proper is. It may have some magical terms among some people, but it doesn't as far as Army definitions are concerned. So this area here, of course, is the Campbell Airstrip property. How far back here they go, I don't know. How far they may exert jurisdiction, I just don't know. They don't in this area here, I realize. This is a firing range, and this is a 6 mile lake area where the float plane range is, and there's transmission facilities. This is a impact range out in here.
Where is the Elmendorf Gate? Where is the, draw a line on there with your pencil, or your pen, that it represents, so to speak, the hurricane wire fence, on one side of which an exclusive federal enclave that doesn't recognize any civilian jurisdiction, and the other side of which yields to the civilian jurisdiction.
There is none. It all is concurrent jurisdiction, Mr. Chairman.
I can pass freely on one side of the gate, and I cannot on the other side of the gate. Draw in the line that connects the hurricane wire fence to the gate.
There is a gate onto Fort, on to Elmendorf that comes up in this area in here. I think it's right in here. There's a gate. This, of course, being a military reservation. The APs, this is all military reservation in here. There's a gate right here that you have to stop and get a pass on. There's another gate down in this area in here, I think, that you have to stop and get a pass on. Then you can't get on any of the rest of this property unless you go through this gate, or gate one out at Fort Richardson, which is right here.
Well,
or gate three, which is out here.
It's unfortunate that the legislative history is not clear on this, but I can personally tell you that the information we had at that time was that that area enclosed by the gates was the base proper, and that was the only area that was excluded from the borough. We were not aware, neither the city nor did anybody else bring to our attention, to the best of my knowledge, the fact that there was any city boundary limits that extended into the military reservation. As a matter of fact, I think the city maps, as of that date, do not, the ones that were published, do not extend into the military reservation. I think they cut off at the reservation, do they not?
I think the ones, and we've looked back,
is that right?
Show the military reservation here, and show the Alaska Railroad Reserve right here, and then, of course, this is a city dock area right in here. But every map that I've ever seen
includes that area,
Mr. Chairman. There was a controversy at one time, a difference of opinion between the Air Force and the Army as to exclusive jurisdiction versus a concurrent jurisdiction. The Judge Advocate General of the Army wrote a decision a long, long time ago, and I say this for the members of the committee, that I used to be the post-judge advocate at Fort Richardson and was assistant staff judge advocate at Fort Richardson, and this was until 1970. And so there was the division of opinion here, and it was simply a question of whether or not State Fish and Game was going to get involved, and that was primarily feed to military activities. But if a crime, and we've done this, and Elmendorf has done this many times, I've called the city police to pick up a drunk driver simply because we had no authority to pick him up. Elmendorf does it too, and they charge him under state law. State law does apply throughout this jurisdiction. The Crimes Assimilation Act and so on and so forth applies throughout the jurisdiction. The state police do have the authority, if they wanted to exercise it, as long as it didn't conflict with the military's purpose, to patrol the area if they wanted to. And they do from time to time. The state troopers will come in and arrest a drunk driver or something of that nature. Or if there's a crime of a civilian versus a civilian on this installation, they either can call the state troopers or they can call the federal marshal.
Your city police, however, do not patrol in the yellow areas.
They do to some extent. There's a worried housing project down in this area, and we do patrol that. Now, we always have.
It's inside the gate.
Well, it's inside this yellow area. There's a road right in here that is excluded from the gate portion. Recently, it was excluded within the last few years. But this particular area right in here, this quarry housing area, is patrolled today, and the streets maintained, and so on and so forth by the city.
Do you patrol inside the hurricane wire fence that's
no,
connected
sir,
to
we
the
do
gate?
Not now. Within the boundaries, which are, you have to have a pass to be on.
Yeah. Senator Hensley?
I don't know if it's really up there.
I think so.
Mr. Chairman, I wished I was a little bit clear as to why the annexation. I feel a little bit like they were shadow boxing in a way. Mr. Sharp has indicated that whether or not they get state funds under the revenue sharing program, they want the annexation. And lawyers are known for their conciseness. I'd like to hear the attorney tell me why the city wants the annexation.
Excuse me. Senator Hensley, Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Sharp covered that, and I'll try to reiterate what he said, if the chairman wants me to. Simply, we realize, and I think that most people that around these military installations realize, that these bases aren't going to be there forever. There's been a tremendous cutback in the military in Anchorage from the standpoint of Fort Richardson. When I first arrived here in 1967, we had two full brigades of soldiers, each with 12,000-15,000 men in each brigade. We had separate battalions for aviation companies. We had a separate command for supply. A tremendous amount of military activity. Now, Fort Wainwright had a full brigade. It was a mechanized tanks and everything. And this, since this very short period of time, since 1967, has dwindled now to the point that Fort Richardson has a part of one brigade entirely, or the United States Army Alaska, entirely in the state of Alaska. They call it now the 172nd Light Arctic Brigade, which is half-staffed. And so the cutback has been extremely tremendous in this area here. When I got here, you used to have to wait 3 or 4 months to get post housing. Now half the housing is vacant. At Fort Wainwright up there, they're abandoning military use of half of the post. They're moving the post headquarters, the general's quarters, the officer's club, the whole thing is being abandoned today. They're cutting down that heat plant completely over there. And this is what's happening in Alaska. Some of this I'm not going to relate because it is documents that I saw when I was on active duty, but there is a lot going to happen in the next few years. Realize a tremendous amount of it's classified documentation in the military now, but there is a lot that's going to happen that we know that's happening today that we can forecast. If this area is abandoned as a military installation and this area is moved over here as a strike command like they have at MacDill Air Force Base, this is not going to be needed anymore, and it will be accessed out just like Campbell Airstrip is. Once that happens, there's a tremendous, tremendous plant out here that's going to have to be maintained. People are going to start moving into this area. They're not going to leave it vacant. They're going to use it for every conceivable type of operation. The same up at Fort Wainwright. There's a hospital up there that may be abandoned at some time. And the city of Fairbanks may want that. But when this happens, somebody has to be there with the authority, the power, and the funds to take it over and to operate it and to make it a viable part of the community. And this is one of the big reasons for the annexation. At least this is the reasoning that has been kicked around as far as I'm concerned in the city council. There are some other reasons, of course, that Mr. Sharp has pointed out. And so for that particular reason alone, it's certainly imperative, in my opinion, that it become annexed. I think, with all due respect to Mr. Carroll, it's probably more imperative right now for Fort Wainwright to be annexed to Fairbanks, but their petition, I understand, is in the mill. If you don't, you end up floundering, and that's too much plant out there. My gracious. I was a legal logistics officer out there, and I must have reviewed millions and millions of dollars worth of contracts refurbishing many parts of that area, which, if they're not utilized, are going to be available for civilian use, for non-military purposes. And if we don't have someone that can get in there and take care of those problems immediately, it's going to end up like a lot of bases throughout the United States when they're closed down, and it's going to be a bunch of old buildings out there that just decay. You see this down at Whittier, for example. The biggest building until they built the Anchorage Westward Hotel was in Whittier, Alaska, and it's completely decayed now. Matter of fact, it cost too much to tear it down, and we just don't want to see that happen.
Chairman, I think it clarifies the thing a bit. It seems to me that the argument, really in terms of impact, argues for an annexation 6 or 7 years ago, in terms of impact. You know,
I've been trying for 3 years now.
Yeah, so your petition is really a prospective thing. You're looking towards deactivation of the site, essentially.
Well, that's one. And the other area, I think, as Mr. Sharp has pointed out, Senator Hensley, if I may, there is a tremendous impact. I don't think anybody disagrees with that point, that there is a tremendous impact to the city of Anchorage now, today, and has existed for a great deal of time, which has cost the people that live in the city of Anchorage and pay taxes there a considerable amount of money. And some relief from that, although the council has gone on record saying that they would want annexation, shared revenues or not, I think in fairness that when this is done, the legislature may want to pass a modified share revenue bill, which would give a certain amount of impact, something to be determined through a real close analysis of to the services provided. And I think that's a basic need today. It was 3 years ago, and it's continued to be that. I don't think that, at least I haven't heard any real objections to that or any questioning of that particular point. So I think it ties today's problems in with the future problems. And I would hate to see something like this defeated today from the city of Anchorage standpoint, because I think by logic you'd end up defeating something that Fairbanks wants, and it would follow on its tails. And I think they have a definite need up there too. And God knows how many times I've stayed over in Murphy Hall over there, and that building is going to be abandoned. Post headquarters, the general's quarters up there, that nice officers club is being abandoned today. And with those things happening, you know, somebody's going to have to go and move in and take those things over, or they're just going to be worthless pieces of junk in a few years. And so that's why I support this. I think that's why the city supports it, and that's why I think it should come to pass.
Senator Hensley, do you have any further questions?
No, thank you.
Any other legislators have any questions, City Attorney? Thank you, Mr. Spencer. How do you want to handle this? Do you want to, is there some order that you'd like to testify the rural representatives?
Yes, sir. We'd like to have Ms. Simon Parker speak first, then Mr. Willis, Mrs. Dodson, Mr. Gary Hughes, and I'll be bringing up the rear.
Fine. Thank you. Proceed.
Chairman, I have to leave now because of another committee, and I'm not walking out on the rural testimony. I'm going to leave a note with the assistant if I can to get written copies of everything. So,
okay.
Hate to especially walk out on a Parker.
Mr. Chairman, Carol, thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. I think it's too bad that these things always get hashed out here. Finally, we do testify, of course, before the Lawful Boundary Commission. I think it's important to point out that the city never brought this proposal before the assembly, nor did it bring any of the proposals of its annexation proposals before the assembly. It doesn't have to, but it would be a good time to discuss the pros and cons at an early date. The interests and rights of the assembly in this matter have been brought up. It's important to point out, of course, that the assembly sets the mill levy for the school taxes, it sets the mill levy for the area-wide general fund, and it sets the mill levy for the service areas, all of which are affected to some degree by any annexation, and we do have a very real interest in what the city's efforts are at annexation. We have a need to know, and I think there's been enough testimony on revenue sharing and on the school impact. I have nothing to add to that. The one point on revenue sharing, however, in the federal general revenue sharing, we are going to have to work something out with the city there, which I would not like to see complicated by any further actions until we can work it out, because the city receives federal general revenue sharing on a prorated basis based on its input to the tax input to the borough's general fund. And ideally, of course, those funds would be returned to the borough for those area-wide services as the city's share, and I'm not sure we've worked out whether we are, in fact, going to get them back from the city's share of the general revenue sharing or not. It's very complicated, and since this is the first time we've been through it, the city has completed its budget. Ours won't be completed until May. We still have this process to go through for the first time. The matter of the joint use, I think that Mr. Sharp brought up some important things there. There are facilities on Elmendorf and Fort Rich which can be of prime importance to the general community someday. The recreational facilities, they have some magnificent ones out there which would be a real boon to the community if they were open to everyone. As I testified at the Upper Cook Inlet Airport hearings, airport study hearings. Ideally, someday, we will incorporate Elmendorf into the system as a cargo airport. I believe this would extend our utilization of Anchorage International as an air carrier airport for a quarter century and probably save us eventually $50 to $100 million in investment for a new airport. And there's no reason why this cannot be done. Elmendorf is ideally located to the port, to the railroad, to the highway system to serve as a cargo facility. This, however, has no bearing particularly upon the annexation. This could be done if Elmendorf were acquired by the state, which I would recommend because I don't think the borough wants to get into the airport business, and I'm not sure, of course, what the city's stand is on it at this time. The other point, however, that Mr. Spencer just discussed on taking over the bases, if the military were to move out, I've had some experience in this area when I was with the Federal Aviation Administration, why we were involved with municipalities who were taking over abandoned military bases and converting them to civilian use. All I can say is it's financial madness to take over a military base until you have a firm agreement with the military as to how long they will pay the maintenance costs. And the maintenance costs on just the upkeep of plant on a military base are, of course, tremendous and far beyond the bounds of most municipalities to bear as a quick one-time shot. You simply cannot afford to take them over. They don't convert that fast. The city of Bangor almost went broke on Dow Air Force Base before they finally moved part of the University of Maine and several other things in there to get it functioning as a civilian establishment. And unless there is an immediate use for the facilities, and developing an immediate use for the amount of facilities on Elmendorf and Fort Rich would take some time. Even if it came at the time the pipeline was built, it would still take a long time to amortize that kind of takeover into the revenue base. At least that was, if I was sitting on the assembly and had to pass on it, I want a firm agreement from the military before I commit any public of Anchorage to that kind of expense. Now, Mr. Chairman, you asked for comment on some other areas which have application here. We are running short on time. On the new boundaries and on the watershed, I did have a few words I would like to say if you want to hear them.
Certainly.
On the question of the new boundaries, I think this would most affect my section in Boniface Muldoon. The city began its new annexation starting from the boundary of the Alaska Methodist University campus here and from the boundary of Russian Jack Springs here. The boundary looked like this. It was in 1967, I believe, that they began to move eastward, possibly a little earlier than that, and annexed these areas here. Now, these were almost all single landowner acquisitions in large parcels ranging from 5 acres to 160. And they were acquired, as all most of the people from Anchorage know, as subdividers moved out, acquired the property, and then were annexed to the city. But this was a case where just one man came before the council and asked for annexation. Now in this area to the east, we have about 20,000 people living in the borough areas, 12,000 people in my section, 6,000 and half of Mr. Willis's that is in Muldoon. Mr. Lang has about 2,000 people living in his portion of the sections up here. And I don't really know what the city population is in these areas that have been annexed. I think they've probably between 3,000 and 4,000 now. But these were all annexed as empty lands and the subdivisions have been built. And that is how we arrived at that crazy quilt pattern. If we are going to draw new boundaries, why, the rights of the people that are within that crazy quilt, I think, still have to be respected to the degree that they should have some vote on any annexations. There's still no petitions being circulated in Muldoon for annexation to the city that I know of, and I don't really know what the temper of the people is out there. When they're asked, they say no. If they were presented with a rational opportunity to vote, and it was laid out for them clearly what services they would gain at what increase in taxation, they might say yes. It's impossible to know without a vote. However, I would point out the impact this boundary pattern has on our programs. We have a very active parks acquisition program going in Muldoon now. We have created three new parks out there in the past year. hope to about make several more acquisitions in the next year. The city, of course, is moving ahead on its parks program very rapidly now. At the same time, I'm not sure that it has any acquisitions scheduled in that area, but the two parks departments are working together trying to overcome the problems of the boundary and create a park system that will serve the entire community out there. This kind of effort towards unification is still progressing at the working level, hopefully. At least the people involved in parks assure me that they still are planning jointly. On the problem of the watershed lies mostly in Chugach State Park. The State Division of Parks, of course, has its authority very clearly under the enabling legislation for the park as to the role of the watershed in the park and that they are to provide protection for the watershed. The Borough Planning and Zoning Authority, of course, also extends over the Chugach State Park, and under that planning and zoning authority, why the borough has a mandate to provide protection for the watershed also. I don't think it is necessary to extend the authority of the City of Anchorage over both of these jurisdictions in order to provide more protection for the watershed at this time. What all this leads up to, of course, is what is the future of unification in Anchorage? There's still a strong citizen desire for unification among the large groups of people outside as well as those within the city. The problem was as much the charter as it was the concept of unification. There was a great deal in the charter that was very new. And without taking a poll, we will never know what elements it was, whether it was the strong executive, whether it was the ombudsman, what factors caused the defeat of both charters in Anchorage. However, under the new municipal code, we do have many options available for unification. And a practical, pragmatic unification that we can take one step at a time if necessary. If we create a true area-wide government in which the role of the borough is clearly understood, reference the role of first and second class cities within that borough, well, I think that the citizens would very rapidly follow on with voting in the area-wide powers that were necessary and voting the powers into those service areas that presently need them and lack them. It would restore, I think, a good deal of the citizen faith in government, and I think that the borough administration is going to bring some options for restructuring the assembly before us very soon. I hope they get it to us before we get into the budget period in Anchorage. But the assembly, most of the assembly members do have a desire to overcome this problem and to do it within the existing municipal code now. It is possible to do this. We do not need any further legislation. The new code will serve us very nicely. I think I'll stop there.
Any questions of Mr. Parker? Let me ask you a question, Mr. Parker, on the annexation, which, because of our time, you touched a lot of areas which I'm very interested in. I'd like to pursue your thoughts further, but we better stick to the annexation, I suspect, this afternoon as much as possible now. If we statutorily annexed the area here that the city desires to the city and also include it within the boroughs of the boundary, you, of course, have no objection as a borough assemblyman if the state wants to give the city of Anchorage any amount of money that they want to. That isn't a problem as far as you're concerned, is it?
Only is it affects the borough's share of shared revenues. It would be if
the greater community would end up with a lot more money if they were eligible, but that would be something maybe Mr. Hensley or somebody else looking to their enlightened self-interest might object to. But assuming that there was to bring in $500,000 more of state money into the greater Anchorage area, you wouldn't object to that, and you don't object to that, I wouldn't think, do you?
I think I would object to the point if it were to impact the Muldoon, if it would impact the Muldoon mill levy, I probably would object, Senator, because
it
would be an untenable position for me to be favoring lowering the mill rate for the city taxpayers while raising the mill rate for the citizens I represent, and that would be the effect.
Well, but wouldn't the amount that the borough loss perhaps be in the order of maybe $50,000 compared with the $300,000 or $400,000 that the total community would gain? In other words, I'm trying to locate the arguments. I can understand why someone from Fairbanks or Juneau or Ketchikan would say we don't want to see more money go into the greater Anchorage community. But I have a hard time understanding as a member of that community, why I would object or you would object to a greater state sharing of funds.
I think, Senator, it is the problem of the difference between the mill rate in the city and those in the service areas. See, what has happened in Anchorage is that the service areas are carrying the full brunt for the expansion of the city. When the expansion occurs in the city, it's in the form of a major office building downtown, which generates great tax revenues to the city and really requires very little expansion of services by the city. When expansion occurs in the borough, it's in the form of residential areas, which are much more expensive to serve, but which generate no more tax revenue than the large building downtown. This is one of the major reasons why the city tax levy, of course, has stayed set steady while the boroughs has continually rose, because most of the expansion and growth has occurred in the borough and generated the need for services. The city's need for services is on a much lower curve than the boroughs. In fact, when the city talks about its great expansion in telephone utility, most of that expansion, of course, has occurred in the borough, and the city, of course, charges the borough residents a premium rate for that telephone service, and therefore is able to operate its utility at a handsome profit.
Right, let me ask you another question then. Let's assume that we completely cut out any revenue sharing for persons that are, and I don't know how we're going to define it, though, within a city, but also on a military base, proper, improper, whatever definition we can work out. And we also expanded the borough to encompass the same area, so that there was no problem here of the city being both inside and outside the borough. Uh-huh. And assume that we could assure ourselves, and I'm not whether we can or not, but just assume that we could assure ourselves there'd be no loss of federal funds. Then what would your position be on the annexation?
If the borough were to expand into the military bases too, I would say great, because I think we'd make out handsomely on our school revenues. According to my conversations with the Department of Education, well, I couldn't be against that, because we'd be making about $300 a pupil what it would cost us to educate.
You mean if you received the existing federal contribution?
Existing federal contribution, yeah. And also we would get the state revenue.
Then your testimony, so far as the annexation, if we can work it around to this, and this is all prospective because we may not be able to, but you do not object to the annexation of the areas to the city, as long as it also, the borough is expanded to cover the same area, and as long as they do not receive state revenue or state sharing, and so long as there is no loss of federal funding of education in the area that we're talking about.
Yes, Senator, I would say if the borough were to expand in that area, why the question of the revenue sharing, of course, then the borough would receive revenue sharing in the same manner as the city.
Yeah.
There's one other point that probably should be brought up, which is the question of reapportionment. If the city were to annex the bases on the terms which were outlined in Mr. Spencer's brief, why I think the net result would be that reapportionment would lead us into four assemblymen from within the city and seven without, because if you remove those 6,500 people that live on Elmendorf Air Force Base from the city population, I think you'd probably get them back to four assemblymen on the one-man, one-vote ratio, and there would be seven from without. So that would, I think, be the result of the reapportionment, because the statement was made that those 6,500 people living on base, of course, are not a part of the borough, but they have been counted for years when the borough was apportioned. Have they not? The attorney left. So you can ask her that question, but basing it on the figures, why, I'm sure on the last reapportionment that they were counted.
Any other questions of any of the legislators? Thank you, Mr. Parker.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Mr. Willis, I'm going to relinquish the chair to Mr. Carroll here for just a minute. I have to make a telephone call. I'll be back in just a second.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Local Boundary Commission, my name is Ed Willis. I represent Section 1 on the Greater Anchorage Area Borough Assembly. Mr. Parker pointed out I would represent two precincts in Muldoon and in the Chugiak Eagle River area, which is not shown on this map, which would lie east of the military reservation and up Eagle River Valley and into the Chugiak area. And if we had the map, the land area would probably be as large as the rest of the borough just to the south. I've served on the assembly as a representative from that area since October of 1966. I would like at this time to submit and make a matter of record the resolution number RE-73-39 that the Borough Assembly passed. I would read it. It's a very short resolution, and I would read it into the record. It's a resolution opposing the annexation of the military bases by the City of Anchorage. Whereas the Local Boundary Commission has submitted a proposal originated by the City of Anchorage to the State Alaska Legislature to annex the urban areas of the military bases of Fort Rich and Elmendorf, and whereas the annexation would allow the City of Anchorage to receive shared revenues for non-rendered services, and whereas the military has expressed no desire to be annexed, and whereas there are many problems, legal and otherwise, which would arise out of the operation of the on-base schools. Now, therefore, be it resolved, the Greater Anchorage Area Borough Assembly is opposed to the city's petition for annexation of the military reservations of Fort Rich and Elmendorf Air Force Base to the city, passed the and approved the 29th day of January 1973, signed by presiding officer Herbert C. Lang.
I wonder if I may stop you right there, Mr. Williams.
Yes, sir.
You have the resolution, and you indicated it was passed. And
yes,
there was some comment earlier about the margin it passed by.
On a 6-5 vote, and I would be quite candid with you, it broke along one of the very few times that our assembly has broke on strictly outside, inside vote. It passed on a 6-5 vote, the outside assemblyman opposing the annexation. And as Mr. Parker and I indicated, we do represent sections. There are six of us who represent on the assembly, those areas outside the city, each of us represent approximately 9,500 to 10,000 people.
You do enjoy the weighted vote there, don't you?
It's under our last reapportionment, the population outside the city was greater than inside, therefore the city has 5 representatives to reflect this. The outside has 6 representatives.
Very well.
I'll just comment very briefly. I think that as an assemblyman, there are these certain legal questions that must be resolved so we know where we stand. And I think there's also the question of fairness. And I think the Attorney General commented on many of these legal questions. May the city annex military bases where the results would be that the city is located part in an organized borough and part in an unorganized borough. The question of the educational responsibilities, and I know that's been discussed at length. And another aspect that I don't know whether it's been raised, I didn't see it, or I don't remember hearing it, but the legal aspects of the extension of the City of Anchorage corporate limits to include military land. The Alaska Statehood Act, and I believe it's Section 11B, discusses the exclusive legislative power of the Congress of the United States over military reservations. Now, I don't know, you know, whether that is pertinent here or not, but certainly this Statehood Act should be researched to see if it would have effect. Now, when we talk about fairness, and I relate this to shared revenues, I'm not going to sit here and say that there is no impact on the city from the bases. I think that there is, but what I am saying is that the legislature should address itself to this problem in a little different manner than this. And certainly when you get into this, if you say that the impact of the military is indeed, it does indeed impact Anchorage, you also have to say that it impacts the borough too. We contract the Spinard Service District police powers with the City of Anchorage. So when you get into shared revenues, I think you have to also, to be fair, Spinard, you know, deserves their share. And I think that's what we're interested in. I think it's unfair in this form now to the rest of the state and to the rest of the borough. Now, in my service district in Eagle River, we're getting certain fire shared revenues for our fire department.
Well, if the military statistics, and if that, in other words, if you just annex the statistics to boost the city share, then, as Commissioner Malott pointed out, it reduces the amount that other people in other sections of the state get, including our own borough. So I think that the legislature should address itself to the impact that military reservations have, not only in Anchorage, but in the Fairbanks area, too. But I think it shouldn't be done here, where it would hurt other areas of the state. Another thing, too, and I guess maybe that's been answered, the military is taking no position, but it does seem like in an annexation such as this, like a marriage, it seems that both partners should express their desire. Certainly the military does have a vested interest, but I'm sure the colonel spoke for the military. Schools, I just believe we've got to be darn certain. And yesterday we talked about, or we heard testimony that indicated from the Department of Education that indeed we might or may very well lose $3.5 million in federal funds. I don't think as legislative people we should gamble on losing it. We should certainly be darn sure that it's not going to affect anything. As an assemblyman, we're going to be looking at a budget, a school budget that we're going to have to pass on, and I understand that it's going to be presented to us, and there's every indication that if we fund it fully, that our taxes are going to have to go up, unless some way we can reduce this. And with this staring us in the face, and with the possibility that we could lose the federal funds, it might place a tremendous burden on the taxpayers locally. I just don't see how that we can logically justify the position that the state-operated school system enjoys now, where they get 100% support. What I'm saying, we've got to be very cautious. Let's don't gamble away what we know we've got now. Now, on this matter of reapportionment, and with a question that Senator Rader posed to Mr. Parker, reapportionment is a great concern to us. If the military base annexed to the city was made a part of the borough, these figures would be used in reapportionment. The precedent has been set. The Supreme Court order denying objection to the interim reapportionment plan addresses itself to this, and state representatives are elected utilizing uniformed military personnel. And I submit, and I disagreed violently at the time, and I discussed it with one of the justices, that it's unfair. Yet, the precedent has been set. Now, of course, if the minority, Justice Buchheber's minority opinion had been confirmed by the Alaska State Supreme Court, it certainly would be much better. And this minority opinion stated that he concurred with the order, but he would eliminate the population base, would eliminate from the population base those members of the military unaccompanied by dependents, living in barracks, on ships, and so on. They constitute 51.9% of the total number of military personnel enumerated in the census. And he further stated that he would submit the reasons for this position in another separate opinion. But it is something that we are vitally concerned with. I'll just flat, unless something can be resolved on this, I would have to oppose it. Where uniformed military personnel who have their residencies outside would be used to apportion that assembly. I certainly have no objection as a public official to those folks who want to vote, that would live there, and I would encourage them to become active. But just for the uniformed military personnel, the troops that are stationed there that have no desire to become active, I just don't think it's fair to utilize these numbers for reapportionment. You know, maybe I shouldn't give my friend Bob any ideas, but another thing that crosses my mind that could happen, last year before the United States Congress, there was a, as I understand it, a bill proposed to allow cities of over 50,000 people to levy a payroll tax on people living or working within a city. You know, if something like this passed, the city could levy a payroll tax on people living out there, the civilian employees who might live in other areas. And I think this would be a valid concern. You know, as a citizen of Eagle River, I'm working on the base. I would want my taxes to go to develop my area. I shop in Anchorage. I have credit cards, for example, with Penny's and NC Company, and I shop in there, and they solicit my trade, and I go in there because I get good service. I think I carry my weight as far as the port, for example, is concerned. I think the merchants charge me, it's prorated back to me. Every item that comes over that port must be paid for, and I'm sure that NC and the various merchants that I trade with in the city prorate that back to me. I think that that I carry my share that way. They certainly want my business, and I always get a parking ticket every time I go down there, so it's usually $2 more. I think the records will
you can check 2 days, you owe me $4.
Yeah, only $4. But anyway, these are things that that have crossed my mind, and of course I have some definite opinions on it. I would just sum up by stating that in its present form, I would oppose it, and maybe I shouldn't be concerned about this, and maybe it doesn't present a problem, but it's just an aside. We hope out in the Chugach Eagle River area to get into some discussions here on incorporating into a second-class city. I don't know whether the military, military bases being part of the city would affect, you know, a decision on whether we could incorporate. I don't know, but I do bring it up. But maybe I can check this out. But it might be a concern. I'll just close by stating that I am opposed to the annexation as an individual assemblyman, to the resolution that would allow the military bases to be annexed.
I relinquish the chair back to Senator Rader now.
Any questions of Mr. Willis? Mr. Willis, so that we certain of your testimony, if there were no state revenue sharing involved, in other words, let's assume that we just excluded any state revenue sharing for military bases of the, you know, whether behind the barbed wire fence, how are we to figure out how to do that? And if we annexed that area, then the area to the city, and also extended the borough to cover the same area, and if we could be assured, and this is something I don't know, and we've heard conflicting testimony, of course, on this, but if we could be assured that this was not going to jeopardize the educational funds, then, as I understand your testimony, you would still be opposed to it,
and
primarily on the basis of the reapportionment,
right,
the apportionment issue.
Right. I just don't think, you know, and when I say that, I'm actually disagreeing with the Alaska State Supreme Court too, but unless this could be resolved equitably, you know.
All right, now let me ask you this. If we could solve that reapportionment issue on some basis, and I don't know what it would be, but on some basis which would indicate that we're only going to count those persons in the military who seem to have in one manner or another chosen to become a resident part of the civilian community on an ongoing basis sort of thing. If we can figure out a way to determine that, and I don't suppose that'd be more than 5% or 10%, I suppose the outside.
Uh-huh.
If we could work out a constitutionally valid way then to handle the reapportionment, then would you still be opposed? Now, and again, I'm not asking you to make a legal opinion, I'm saying if that could be done, assuming that it could be done. And
yeah.
I have no idea whether or not it can.
Well, predicated on that and also that it wouldn't affect maybe Eagle River wanting to incorporate sometime, you know, when we get into it, I could see no reason why it, you know, shouldn't happen.
Your thought is that this area might be an area that Eagle River would want to annex.
No, no. What I was alluding to, Senator, and I'm not an attorney, but isn't there something in the municipal code that states that if you border an existing city, that it could preclude you from incorporating because they would just say to you, well, you can get your services from that city? And, you know, I don't know how you could do it here because there's 8 miles, I think, all the way through the military base. So I don't know, you know, as a practical matter, whether you could do it, but maybe as a legal thing. You know, I don't want to tell you something and then come back and I've thought of something else. I'm trying to think of everything while I'm here.
Okay, other than that fact, then, what other objection would you have, do you think?
Well, I don't know of any other.
I make a lot of assumptions here that these problems can be handled.
And I would reserve the right to change my mind if I thought of something more.
You know, I used to dislike the public servants that changed their mind, but then I found out that that's the only type that's worth talking to, you know.
Well, okay. And I would like to also point out that that our press, the Eagle River Chugiak Star, took a different attitude toward this than our friends at the news. So I would leave some copies here for you.
Thank you very much.
Incidentally, we're the fifth largest growing area in the state, too.
I wish you could say fifth largest city.
Maybe we will one of these days.
I think it would be a great thing myself, really. Let's see, the next witness from the borough.